Lecture 19, Non-Conscious Aspects of Personality.
If I asked just about anyone to write down the names of the most famous psychologists of all time, I have no doubt that the name Sigmund Freud would be on almost everybody's lists. That would be wrong. As we discussed, Freud wasn't a psychologist, but virtually everybody's heard of him. Although he was a physician, a neurologist, rather than a psychologist, Freud had a dramatic impact not only on psychology, but on other intellectual domains as well. Most people also have at least a vague notion of some of Freud's ideas. For example, it's commonly known that Freud stressed the importance of unconscious processes in human behavior. It's also widely known that he thought a person can get stuck or fixated at certain stages of childhood development, that interpreting people's dreams can give us insight into their problems, and that little kids want to have sex with their parents. Now, most contemporary psychologists don't agree with much of what Freud said, but they still give him a lot of credit for getting us to think about the human mind and personality and psychological problems in a different way. One of Freud's primary insights, the one I want to focus on in this lecture, was that much of what influences people's emotions and behavior occurs outside of their conscious awareness. Freud would say that to understand people's personalities, we have to consider unconscious processes. At any given moment, we are aware of only a small portion of what's actually going on around us. And we are also aware of only a small portion of what's happening in our own mind. At this moment, you are conscious of only a small fraction of the external stimuli and internal processing that are going on. And that's a good thing. Your brain has a limited capacity to think consciously about things, so it handles most tasks without you having to think consciously about what you're doing. Right now, your brain is making sense out of all of these sounds coming out of my mouth without you having to think consciously about the process or be aware of how it's interpreting what I'm saying. But if I suddenly use an unfamiliar word, you might start to think consciously about what I mean. The idea that most of our behaviors and emotions are mediated by processes that occur below the level of our conscious awareness is taken for granted by modern psychologists. But it wasn't at the time that Freud started talking about it. Freud went a step further than just suggesting that much of our behavior results from processes that we're not consciously aware of. Freud believed that the unconscious mind contains primitive desires and urges that influence our actions without our awareness. He saw the unconscious mind as a cauldron of primitive impulses, most of them involving sex and aggression, that are unconscious because they would be too disturbing or frightening for us to be aware of. So these dark motives are kept locked away in an unconscious repository. He also suggested that people's psychological problems stem mostly from things that are going on in their unconscious mind. The essential problem is that we have dark, animalistic impulses that need to be satisfied, but the rational, decision-making part of our brain knows that we can't go around satisfying our urges like a wild animal. And if unfulfilled, this tension between the demands of our animal nature and the rules of society creates psychological problems. Freud developed a method of psychotherapy called psychoanalysis to help make these unconscious tensions conscious, because he thought that was the only way to expose and deal with this mess. Not many modern psychologists believe the details of this aspect of Freud's theory, although some do adopt offshoots and modifications of it. But they do believe his central premise that non-conscious processes influence behavior in ways that people don't realize. You might have noticed that I just used the word non-conscious, whereas I had been using the word unconscious when talking about Freud's ideas. Because Freud's ideas about the unconscious mind have fallen out of favor and carry so much conceptual baggage, most researchers in psychology use the word non-conscious to distinguish modern scientific ideas about non-conscious processes from Freud's conjectures about the unconscious mind. So as I talk about aspects of your personality that you're not aware of, I'm generally going to use the word non-conscious. Because many of Freud's ideas seemed pretty weird, and researchers didn't have a good way to study things that people aren't aware of in their own minds, scientific psychologists lost interest in non-conscious processes for many years. But then in the 1950s and 60s, interest was renewed, initially within cognitive psychology, by the discovery of the cocktail party phenomenon. Imagine yourself at a large party. There's a lot of noise, a lot of hubbub. So when you're talking with people, you have to focus very carefully on what they are saying and ignore everything else. There are other conversations all around, but you're focusing only on the one in which you are engaged and pretty much screening out everything else that's going on. In fact, if I ask you what the other people around you were talking about while you were carrying on a conversation with someone, you probably couldn't tell me. Even though they're within hearing distance, you're totally oblivious to what they're saying. Until, out of the hubbub, you hear someone say your name, and your ears perk up. Huh? You've had that happen, right? Well, what's that tell us? It tells us that you've actually been monitoring all of those other conversations all along, or at least your brain has been. While you're thinking about the conversations in which you're engaged, your brain is keeping track of what else is going on around you. Only it's doing so non-consciously, without you thinking consciously about it. Only if it picks up something that might be important to you, like your name, does your brain bother you by bringing it to conscious awareness so that you can figure out what's going on. The cocktail party phenomenon tells us not only that your brain is monitoring things non-consciously, but also that it's using information stored in your memory to make non-conscious decisions about how to respond. After all, your brain recognized your name non-consciously, so it was pulling information from memory as it monitored the situation. It might have also gotten your attention if someone had mentioned your hometown or your occupation or some other personally relevant topic. Non-consciously, your brain knew what might be important to you. Researchers were able to study this sort of non-conscious effect by putting headphones on people and playing different messages to each of their ears. They'd tell people to listen carefully to one of the messages. They'd be tested on it later, and then ask participants about the message in the other ear, the one they were not consciously monitoring. People would claim not to know anything about what it said, yet certain kinds of words would pop out and get their attention. Not only their own name, but also words pertaining to sex and curse words. These findings led researchers to realize that at the broadest level, human beings possess two distinct systems that process information, influence emotion, and guide behavior. To say it differently, there are two basic types of thinking, and they go by a variety of names: non-conscious versus conscious, automatic versus controlled, and system one versus system two. You're already pretty familiar with the conscious system, system two, because, well, you're consciously aware of the way that it works. If you're trying to make a decision, whether about something important, like where to live or what job to take, or something trivial, like what to have for dinner or what present to buy somebody, you're consciously aware of what you're thinking about. You can make lists of what the considerations are, the pros and cons, and you can articulate what your thought processes are. And afterwards, you can explain to me the basis of your decision, or at least the conscious basis of your decision. Conscious thought is obviously important, but it has some drawbacks. You can think consciously about only one thing at a time. You can jump around from topic to topic pretty rapidly, but at any given moment, you can think consciously about only one thing. So imagine that you're driving, and you're trying to figure out which turn to take. And while you're trying to figure out where you are and where you're supposed to go, the person in the passenger seat is asking you about what you want for dinner. You simply can't process those two streams of information consciously at the same time, in spite of what habitual multitaskers may tell you. Conscious thought is also rather slow and deliberate. You often can't make instantaneous judgments consciously. So if you had to rely solely on conscious thought, you wouldn't be able to make moment-to-moment decisions quickly enough to survive. Fortunately, we also have System 1, the non-conscious system. The non-conscious system can process lots of information simultaneously and process it at all very rapidly. But you're not aware of anything that's going on inside the system until an answer or a reaction pops out. You engage in many behaviors all day long, many of them very complicated behaviors, using the non-conscious system. Just talking is usually totally non-conscious. As you're chatting with someone, your words usually just come rolling out. You aren't choosing your words consciously. Of course, sometimes people do try to manage their speech consciously, when you want to be careful of what you're saying. Some conscious thought might be involved, but usually it's not. Now think of what this says about personality. Many manifestations of your personality, ways in which you tend to feel or behave, are not mediated by conscious thought. You often don't deliberately and consciously decide to act the way you do, to have the reactions that you have, to be the person that you are. It just comes out with little or no conscious thought or deliberate control on your part. Now, sometimes you do make deliberate, conscious decisions that reflect aspects of your personality. If you're a highly conscientious person, you might plan things out and purposefully get organized and talk to yourself in ways that keep you on task. Or if you're facing an ethical dilemma, you might think carefully and consciously about your values and make a conscious decision to take one course of action or another. Or if you're a vengeful person, you might lie awake at night consciously plotting how to get back at somebody. So sometimes conscious thought can reflect aspects of our personality and create our typical ways of responding. But much of what determines your personality is entirely non-conscious. It's not the sort of unconscious that Freud was talking about, though. It's not a seething cauldron of aggressive and sexual urges that fuels our behavior, although there are certainly motivational inclinations in there. To think about what the non-conscious aspects of personality are, we need to make a distinction between non-conscious processes and non-conscious content. The processes that occur non-consciously involve brain mechanisms that process information in ways you aren't aware of. There's nothing particularly mysterious about this, although it is terribly complicated. Computers can process lots of information all at once to make decisions and run equipment and even drive cars, and they do so presumably without any conscious awareness of what they're doing. They are non-conscious information processing devices. Your brain isn't exactly like a computer, but it's similar to the extent that it's also an information processing device. And the analogy helps us to see that mechanisms can process information and make decisions without conscious awareness. So the fact that you can process information and make decisions non-consciously isn't too hard to grasp. The more challenging part is to explain the content of the information that's being processed non-consciously, because that's what makes people's personalities different. Your brain's non-conscious processes are using somewhat different non-conscious content from the content that my brain uses. So what's actually in there, in your non-conscious? Well, that question is misleading, because it implies that the non-conscious is a place in your mind, a dark closet with things in it that you don't know about. In fact, non-conscious processes take place in many different parts of the brain. But the internal content that influences your non-conscious reactions is just stored in memory, like other information in your brain. Let me ask you a question. What color do you associate with the word stop? When the answer popped up in your mind, red, where'd that information come from? And did you have to think consciously about it? Or did the answer just come out of nowhere? I suspect that you associated red with stop very quickly without having to think about it consciously. And when you're driving, I suspect that you respond very quickly and automatically when the light turns red, without consciously thinking, oh, the light turned red, and red means stop. The association between stop and red is stored in the memory that your conscious mind uses, but your non-conscious processes also have ready access to it. But that's a very simple association, one that doesn't have much relevance or impact outside of driving. And just about everybody has that same association. But some of our non-conscious associations are idiosyncratic. You and I both automatically associate red with stop. But you may have developed a very different set of automatic associations to certain situations and events or kinds of people from the associations I have. When you encounter a particular situation or event or kind of person, often some emotion or thought or behavior pops out of your mind, just like red popped out when I asked about stop. But that automatic non-conscious association may be different from the one I would have to the same stimulus. Let me give you one interesting example. Research has been done on the non-conscious effects of particular stimuli on people who are and are not religious. Presumably, religious people have different associations to certain stimuli and situations than those of non-religious people. For example, for a Christian, stimuli such as a cross or a lamb or even just the word spirit have different associations than they do for a non-Christian. Researchers were interested in how far the effects of those associations go. Perhaps just seeing or hearing stimuli with religious associations could start non-conscious processes in religious people, yet have no comparable impact on non-religious people. Several studies have explored this possibility by exposing religious and non-religious people to incidental religious stimuli to see how it affects their behavior. A meta-analysis of a number of these studies showed that incidental religious symbols led religious people to behave in a less selfish and more generous way on experimental tasks. But the presence of religious symbols or words had no overall effect on the generosity of non-religious people. So just walking through an average day, religious people's behavior may be changed in subtle ways when they experience stimuli with a religious association, even if they don't think consciously about it or even consciously detect it. I used religious associations as the example here, but all of us carry associations around in our heads that can be triggered non-consciously and affect our feelings and behavior. And as with religious symbols, we don't have to detect these stimuli consciously. Research shows that stimuli can have these effects on us even if researchers present them subliminally so that research participants don't consciously see them at all. The bottom line is that you and I might respond differently in a particular situation because we have different non-conscious associations to stimuli that are present. We also might respond differently because we have different motives. As I said, the basic premise of Freud's view of the unconscious was that your behavior is motivated by unconscious urges that you're not aware of, and undesirable, animalistic urges at that. Although he was wrong on the details, modern research shows that people do have motives that they aren't aware of. We call these non-conscious motives implicit, to distinguish them from explicit motives that people are aware of and can think about. The idea that people have motives that they aren't aware of creates a problem for researchers in psychology. As you know, psychologists depend a great deal on questionnaires and interviews to ask people about themselves. And we certainly have well-designed and highly valid self-report measures of people's motives. But by definition, people can report only on their explicit or conscious motives, which leaves us in a bind. How can we find out what people's implicit motives might be, the ones they aren't consciously aware of? One solution is to use projective tests to get at people's implicit, non-conscious motives. Projective tests provide people with an ambiguous stimulus or an unstructured task of some kind, such as an ambiguous picture or a task that can be accomplished in many ways. The idea is that people's motives will come out in how they interpret the ambiguous picture or deal with the unstructured task, even if they can't identify or verbalize what their motives are. Something inside of the person is leading him or her to respond to the ambiguous, unstructured situation in the way he or she does. In the case of implicit motives, the most popular measures have been variations of tests modeled on the thematic apperception test, the TAT. The TAT involves a set of drawings of ambiguous situations. For example, one picture shows a woman lying in bed with a man standing by the bedside, shielding his eyes or grasping his forehead. It's not clear. And the respondent is asked to tell a story about the scene. Who are these people? What's going on? What led up to the scene in the picture? And what happened afterwards? It's fascinating to hear the kinds of stories that people tell. The stories differ a great deal in who the respondents think the people in the picture are and what their relationship is. Some think the woman's asleep. Some think she's drunk. Some think she's dead. Sometimes the man is her husband or lover. Sometimes he's a guy who picked her up in a bar last night. Respondents even describe the people's emotions differently. Some think the man is covering his eyes out of guilt. Others that he's rubbing the sleep out of his eyes as he gets up to go to work early. Of course, you can't tell too much about someone from the story he or she tells about any particular picture. But after coding a person's stories about several of these ambiguous pictures, certain themes often emerge. You can begin to get a sense of how people interpret the world, thereby shining some light on their concerns and their motives, even if they can't consciously identify or explain what those motives are. What's interesting is that if you measure a particular motive using this sort of projective technique, let's say you measure the motive to have power and control over other people, and you also administer standard self-report personality scales on which people answer questions about their motives, the scores on the two measures often don't correlate very highly. In other words, the non-conscious implicit motives reflected in the stories people tell on the projective tests don't necessarily relate to the explicit motives that they report on questionnaires. Researchers have spent a lot of time trying to understand why the implicit projective measures and explicit self-report measures don't seem to be getting at the same thing. Now, one conclusion might be that one or both of the measures aren't any good, that one or both aren't actually measuring people's motives. But research shows that measures of both implicit motives, as measured by the TAT, and explicit motives, as measured by self-report questionnaires, do relate to people's thoughts and behaviors and emotions. So measures of both implicit and explicit motives are measuring something that relates meaningfully to people's actual behavior. Both projective tests and self-report questionnaires are valid and predict certain behaviors and reactions. The best conclusion is that people have two sets of motives, one non-conscious implicit set and one conscious explicit set that may or may not converge, but both sets manifest in people's personalities. Given what we know about non-conscious versus conscious processing, about System 1 and System 2 thinking, it's really not surprising that people can have non-conscious motives that don't necessarily line up with their conscious motives. Sometimes we have automatic, gut-level desires to do something, and sometimes we think carefully about what we should do. And there's no reason that these two processes will necessarily lead to the same motivation. In fact, we are sometimes motivated to do something that we consciously tell ourselves we shouldn't be doing, which shows that we can have competing motivational influences. Another thing we've learned is that implicit non-conscious motives predict people's long-term outcomes in life better than explicit conscious motives do, whereas explicit motives predict people's specific choices on particular tasks better than non-conscious motives. For example, scores based on a projective measure of achievement motivation, which is a measure of implicit non-conscious motives, predict long-term success better than a self-report questionnaire does. And a projective measure of power motivation predicts long-term success as a business manager better than a self-report measure of power motivation. My reading of this is that when we're confronted with an explicit decision, something specific that we have to decide right now, we tend to think about it consciously. So our conscious motives figure prominently in our reactions. But as life unfolds, there are many subtle, seemingly unimportant decisions and choices that we don't think about consciously. And in those unimportant situations, our non-conscious motives are likely to be operating. When we aren't thinking consciously, we go with our gut. So, over the long haul, our non-conscious motives and the decisions we don't think deeply about nudge us along without us even thinking about them. To conclude, let me mention one other example of how non-conscious processes can influence behavior in ways that make people different from each other. Habits. A habit forms when people are cued to perform a behavior automatically without making a conscious decision to do so. Many of us have the habit of buckling our seatbelt as soon as we get in the car, or a habit of following a certain routine as we get ready for work each morning. In each case, a certain contextual cue, getting into the car or getting out of bed, cues an automatic pattern of behavior. If you have habits for these kinds of things, you don't consciously think to yourself, well, I'd better buckle my seatbelt, or sit on the edge of the bed each morning and ponder what to do to get ready for work. You just buckle your seatbelt, or start your day, or whatever, without any conscious thought or deliberation. Non-conscious processes are in control. Your day is filled with habitual responses, and they help to make you who you are. Habits are exceptionally efficient because they allow us to perform certain actions without devoting time or energy to figuring out what to do or how to do it. The downside is that because they're automatic, habits sometimes unfold even though they aren't the best response in a particular situation. So we sometimes act out of habit, even when it's not the optimal thing to do, and even when it conflicts with our intentions. I still open the cabinet door under my kitchen sink to throw something in the garbage, even though it's been over 10 years since I lived in a house with the garbage can under the sink. Some habits die hard. Neuroscience research shows that as habits form and strengthen, control of the behavior shifts from areas of the brain that are associated with conscious thinking and with goal-directed control to brain areas that are involved in perceiving stimuli and initiating actions, the sensory motor network. That's exactly what we'd expect. Habits take control away from the higher conscious decision-making levels and give it to brain regions that can perceive and react automatically and non-consciously. The fact that much of our personality operates outside of our awareness has a couple of important implications. First, given that non-conscious processes affect our reactions, we can't know for sure why we do certain things. If associations that you don't know you have can be triggered by things that you're not even aware of, you can't be certain why you react as you do. You'll usually be able to give an explanation for your behavior, but all you can report is what you're consciously aware of. You don't know what you don't know. Second, the fact we aren't privy to non-conscious influences helps to explain why it's often so hard to change our behavior. Let's take a behavior such as procrastination. Many people who procrastinate don't understand why they're always putting things off, because they feel like they're motivated to get their work done. They firmly believe that they are motivated to avoid procrastination, and they can't understand why it continues to be a problem. There are many possible explanations, but one is that non-conscious processes are operating that keep them procrastinating. Perhaps they have implicit motives that are being satisfied by putting things off. Who knows? My point is that it's hard to manage your own behavior when you're not aware of all of the things that cause it. Freud would have said that you don't know why you do what you do because the answer is so disturbing that it's locked in your unconscious. But a better answer is that much of your behavior is managed non-consciously, and you are often not aware, and in fact you can't be aware, of why you do many of the things that you do.